Welcome, everyone, to episode number 104 of Underserved. Joining me today is Aaron Harris, Global CTO at Sage Software. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Aaron, thank you so much for joining us today on Underserved.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to talk to you.
So way back when, out in the sticks in Vergennes, Vermont, a young man discovers technology. What happens next?
I imagine it's a bit like your own story. I think I was 11 or 12 years old. A friend had a father who bought a Commodore 64. I was at his house. I saw it in the corner. I got my fingers on the keyboard and I just was hooked from the first moment. My parents got me my own Atari 800 XL, 64 kilobytes of RAM. For Christmas that year, you know, I had to be a bit different. But I've been coding ever since.
What else are you into besides programming? Like, are you playing any sports or doing anything else outside?
I'm not sure if this comparison is particularly good for my reputation, but Elon Musk is about a week younger than I am. And if you read his biography, he basically talks about computers, motorcycles, and, you know, social shenanigans. And that's kind of the way I grew up in Vermont. You know, I spent my time by myself writing software on my little computer, riding motorcycles, playing backyard football, backyard baseball, you name it, right? Traditional Norman Rockwell 80s youth in Vermont.
Rolling any 20-sided dice for D&D?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, one of the programs I wrote for the Atari 800 was the ability to store your character and print out a character sheet with your information on it, which really combined two of the nerdiest parts of my childhood, the Dungeons & Dragons and the computer, into one glorious result.
I built that exact same program on the Commodore VIC-20. So at 12, though, you decide to go pro and get your first consulting gig developing something?
Yeah. My mother was a piano teacher growing up. In one of those moments of trying to support their kids with their hobby, she asked me to an inventory of her piano music and to help her keep track of it as she sold music to her students. So I built an inventory system for music teachers for their sheet music in Atari 800 XL. She paid me $100, which inflation adjusted, I don't know, it's got to be like $400 or $500 now for that. So pretty good earnings for a 12-year-old.
So besides that, like, what are you trying to weave the computer into other aspects and school assignments and so on?
Yeah. You know, I remember in my calculus class, you remember as a kid when you'd get those big poster boards and you had to bring in a poster board with, you know, some story on it or whatnot. We were asked to create a sine wave or some other illustration. And I decided that it would be much more exciting to write a program on my computer that would take some inputs and draw the sine wave. And I brought the computer into class, hooked it up to a TV, and ran it to crickets. But my teacher did appreciate the novelty in the way I approached the assignment.
Yeah, it's sometimes hard to gain the admiration of your peers with a cool sine wave graphing program. So that doesn't deter you from wanting to study CS in college?
Yeah, so as predicted, I did start off in computer science. I actually got bored pretty quickly. And this is not to say that I was some genius at computer science. It's just that I think the early principles in computer science, it's a bit of a slog to get through them. I got distracted. I had a friend in an accounting program, and this program allowed you to put your master's degree with your bachelor's degree. And to this day, I don't know how he convinced me, because never in a million years would I have thought that I would go into accounting. But he convinced me to switch out of computer science to accounting. So I did a bachelor's in accounting and a master's in information systems.
Okay. And this is at Brigham Young University out in Utah?
Yep, exactly.
Very cool. What do you decide to do with these double degrees?
Well, if you know what my title is right now in the company that I work for, you can see that the career sort of predicted itself. But while I was in college, also a bit predictably, I made money building inventory or accounting systems, right? I built an accounting system for the campus design department, and I built an accounting system for a local home builder. So this was, you know, back in the early 90s, mid 90s, right? So helping home builders track the costs of building homes and profit and all that. And a very close friend was in the MBA program that was holding a business plan competition. So, you know, he recruited me to enter the competition with him. You know, we used my real life business building software for construction companies. We entered it into the competition and our pitch was really, really straightforward. This is a really cool new Windows-based construction management software. And the state of the art right now in the industry is a product called Timberline, which is actually a DOS software. And wouldn't you rather buy a Windows solution over a DOS solution? And we really thought we had this nailed. You know, we modeled out how we were going to take the market away from Timberline in about 5 years. And we did really well. We got second place. So super excited about that. Developed some interest from angel investors. But the thing that was a bit discouraging was we lost to, first place was awarded to a fellow who had a novel way of doing sort of pyramid marketing with college kids selling aluminum siding. And
sounds like a brilliant innovator.
Yeah, it sort of diminishes the thrill of wowing the audience with a technological genius.
So when other people find out about this product, like, is there any interest from other people or investors in it?
Yeah, so did get some investment interest, got some offers to do some seed funding. We called it angel funding at the time. I turned them down. You know, I think as a youngster, it's hard to accept the responsibility of being an entrepreneur. So I shut the business down and I took a job working for Arthur Andersen, which at the time was one of the big six accounting firms. So, you know, I went to work there doing, you know, what you would expect me to be doing IT work for them. But to me, that was a very safe and secure choice with a sort of a guaranteed future.
Yeah. I mean, who's going to tell you not to take a big six job with an accounting degree back then?
Yeah, exactly. My parents were so proud. Everybody was so proud. Family was asking me to help them with their tax returns, you know, not knowing that I'm actually a computer scientist. Right. But it's like, why would you turn that down?
And so there's some evolution then, you know, where Arthur Andersen is spinning out Andersen Consulting. What happens next?
Yeah. I mean, my career is kind of a story of irony. So my job at Arthur Andersen in part was to merge Andersen Consulting and Arthur Andersen's sort of core technology foundation. So those of you who know the history here, Andersen Consulting went on to be Accenture. Another ironic twist, the reason why they renamed themselves to Accenture is because Arthur Andersen wanted to extort like $8 or $10 billion out of them for the Arthur Andersen name. And so they said, you know what, we're going to come up with our own name. And the story's got another ironic twist here. So not long after I left, Arthur Andersen ceased to exist. So, you know, I got out of there before the future disappeared before my eyes. And Accenture ended up making the world's greatest decision.
Some might argue you made the world's greatest decision because you jumped off that lily pad into something that seemed riskier. But what happens?
Leaving Arthur Andersen, moved out to Silicon Valley. So I had a coworker whose uncle was kind of a serial entrepreneur. His name was David Thomas. He had hooked up with a woman named Ann Winblad, who was a venture capitalist. And together they decided to do web-based accounting software. So this was late 99. I saw what he was trying to do, got super excited about it, decided, you know, I'm old enough now to take some risks, and moved my family to Silicon Valley, San Jose, California. I became the first full-time engineer at Intact. And the rest is sort of history. For my age, I have a very, very short resume.
Now, the name Intact, who came up with it? What does it mean?
So that was David Thomas. To this day, it still gets misspelled. Two A's often, forgetting the two C's. It's really simple. It stands for Internet Accounting.
Okay. And so you're the first developer at Intact. You're in like San Jose, like Los Gatos area, heart of Silicon Valley. Who are your contemporaries then?
Yeah, I mean, for somebody like me, growing up in Vermont, moving to Silicon Valley and being in the heart of all this innovation was just so exciting. So just down the street from us was Netflix. You know, I drove past Netflix every day on the way to work. It was one building. Most of the building was a garage where they would put the DVDs into Postal Service trucks. eBay was just across the highway, about a mile away. We were 2 miles from Apple's Cupertino campus. campus, the original Cupertino campus. Google was 3 miles away, you know, so if you really geek out about the industry and technology companies, there couldn't be a more exciting place to do a startup.
So you're kind of ahead of your time thinking about, you know, delivering a multi-tenant SaaS product to the market. How do you build it? What do you use? And what challenges do you run into?
You know, first of all, we were pretty young, and with youth comes a bit of healthy naivety, a bit of overconfidence in some ways, and maybe in other ways, not having enough confidence. But at the time, it seemed super obvious to us. There was no sort of defined architectural pattern called multi-tenancy. It just seemed obvious to me that if you're going to build a web-based application, you build one piece of software that runs once for every customer. And of course, you know, at the time, there were no public cloud providers, right? We didn't have Azure or AWS. Very limited database choices, not a lot of history of programming languages that were sort of successfully scaled on the internet. But it was pretty simple, right? We did a PHP application running on an Oracle backend, multi-tenant from day one. I used to have to explain to prospective customers and investors, you know, why we chose PHP. It had a reputation for high-scale websites in sort of less respectable industries. But as soon as Facebook sort of got big and took on PHP as their language, I was absolved from having to tell that story.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Maris Consulting Group, embracing the power of people in technology. For more information, visit mariscg.com. That's mariscg.com.
So you made the right choice there in going multi-tenant, and it may have seemed obvious to you, but there were plenty of people who said, you know what, we'll just do a separate instance of the code for each customer under its own vhost. And if we have 100 customers, we'll just patch it 100 times.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, and then when it becomes 1,000 customers, I'll just write some scripts to patch it 1,000 times. And oh, shoot, if they want to customize it, oh, we'll let them do customization at the code level and at the database level, because what harm can that possibly do? They've got their own database. They, you know, they're running their own code instance. And, you know, before you know it, it becomes completely unwieldy, too expensive to manage. But it does force some real innovation. So, you know, if you're a multi-tenant provider where it's one database hosting everybody's data, how do you allow them to customize, right? How do you allow them to add fields or objects or their own business logic? And we weren't the only ones, by the way. Salesforce followed the same pattern, you know, a little bit ahead of us. You have to treat it as configuration. You've got to have this sort of religious dedication to multi-tenancy where there's only one upgrade. Everybody gets upgraded. Nobody gets disruption. And you've got to solve scalability from a horizontal perspective. In other words, you know, how many tenants can we support, you know, versus the traditional scaling, which is vertical? How big of a tenant can run on the system?
Now, back at this time, I was building some software, tax software, property related. A lot of the customers didn't want their data on the internet. Like, how do you kind of talk them into trusting you to have their data on the internet, commingled with other people's inside of one database?
Yeah, I'm going to use a .com for my accounting. yeah, I mean, that was the number one objection. It was very difficult for us to overcome that objection with prospective customers. So, you know, we did some things obvious, some of them novel. You know, some of the things we did is we made technology choices that we could then tell to our prospective customers so that they would feel more confident. So, for example, we chose to run an Oracle Enterprise as our backend database. At some point, you know, we chose IBM to be our hosting provider. And so we would very prominently put that into our marketing material to sort of associate these trusted brands with our product, which, you know, nobody had heard of, and, you know, a problem that nobody had thought of solving on the internet before. So funny story there. It was such an issue that at some point we put a link into the application right next to the help button that said, "See my data." It's really meant to provide some comfort to our customers who have trusted us. They've thrown their data up in the cloud. So the See My Data link would open up a webcam in the cage, in our data center, pointed at the servers where the data resided. And this thing ran for about a year and we sort of forgot about it. We had a little incident. It turned out somebody clicked that. We had somebody in the data center doing maintenance, you know, bending over and squatting around the equipment, you know, not knowing there's a webcam. But thankfully, we'd reached a point where it had served its purpose and we were able to retire it. And now I've got a story that I've told 1,000 times at parties in Silicon Valley.
That is a good one. You had another story about some chicanery you had to do to move data centers.
Yeah. And again, I sort of have to remind people that this is pre-public cloud. You know, we had all of this ourselves. And, you know, this was before virtualization either. It was bare metal servers. And we had to move data centers. And we figured out the only way to do this in a way that would minimize downtime was to actually pull the hard drives from the databases and physically move them over to the new data center, have everything ready, put them in the new database servers and flip the switch and turn it on. And we further refined the process. Figuring out the best way to do that to avoid potential traffic issues was for our VP of operations to use his motorcycle and his saddlebags, right? So you can imagine the whole entire fate of the company at some point for about 20 minutes was in the saddlebags of a motorcycle, you know, taking all of our customers' data from one data center to the other. I mean, and never in a million years can you get away with this sort of thing. But, you know, in the early days of, you know, software as a service and multi-tenant solutions, you know, there was a lot of these moments where there was some high anxiety about, you know, doing this sort of maintenance for customers.
It had never been done before. Like you said, you had to figure it out. You had to find a way. Speaking of things that hadn't been done before, like you guys were trying to sell digitally with online ads and ads in the paper as opposed to like a traditional pounding the phone sales force. What's that like?
Yeah, I mean, I tell people a lot that Intacct sort of mirrors the history of Silicon Valley. So back in the early aughts, right, you know, venture capital was easy to come by. The name of the game was growth at any cost, which those of us who have been around a while have seen this cycle play itself out a couple times. But we were running full page ads in the Wall Street Journal, trying to drive accountants to our website to, you know, to go through a wizard, give us their credit card, give us their QuickBooks file, right? And we would migrate them to the web. And of course, nobody bought it. We, you know, had almost no revenue. We had very committed investors to a point. I mean, Anne Winblad was just tremendous. She had a lot of faith in what we were doing. But ultimately, there's the dot-com crash, purse strings tighten, you know, everybody cuts costs. You can only go so long on investor confidence. And so we had to get real, right? So we cut the company back by about 80%. We went down to 18 people, I think, 19 people. We all took pay cuts. We decided we had to hire a sales team, one sales rep to start with. And at some point, we decided we just couldn't afford to build at the speed we needed to in Silicon Valley. So while we retained engineers in Silicon Valley, we also started a team in India. The point is that sort of experience as a startup founder or employee forces a real culture of paying attention to what customers really need, always being on the front line, you know, being super careful about how you spend money. And it sort of creates a sort of a long-term pattern of reliable growth, I'd say.
So while the markets kind of got you in a bit of a stranglehold, you had another interesting story that happened to you in 2002 with an ACH system.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the interesting thing, we were a tiny little company, but we were in Silicon Valley, right? And we had, you know, well-known venture capitalists behind us. And so we were able to do these partnerships that were just crazy, right? We had a partnership with one of the largest banks, still one of the largest banks today in the US. We did a partnership with one of the big six. So we had all these co-development partnerships we did with these large organizations who were wanting to get in on this new software as a service thing. And so we built an integration that would allow our customers to initiate ACH payments from within our product. That sounds like super normal now. It was incredibly novel at the time. The problem is this partner, you know, this very, very large bank had no experience doing this sort of thing, right? They only did it with enterprise customers. And so at some point, you know, after we launched the product, we got this like very frantic call from the operations team at this bank, basically telling us that the system had gone down, right? So imagine the ACH system for one of the largest banks in the country going down. And you know, what it came down to was they had an FTP system where their enterprise customers would dump a file, right? A text file with all the ACH instructions, but it wasn't set up to handle UTF-8. So, you know, we had allowed a UTF-8 character, a couple of characters to get into the file, and the system was sort of so old, it didn't know what to do with it, and it just crashed. You don't have that sort of fun these days. Things tend to be a bit more reliable. But again, one of those moments of high anxiety as a startup back in the early aughts.
Tough times, though. Like, the original investors are starting to lose some confidence. You started thinking maybe we might need to sell?
Yeah, at some point again, investors can only invest for so long. We were getting a little bit of traction. You know, we'd grown revenue a little bit, but we reached a point where we were in a bit of, you know, a fire sale situation. We just could not continue to run the business. So, you know, during that time, I met with most of the, I would say, the obvious candidates to acquire a web-based accounting software company, including my current employer, right? And, you know, some of the luminaries now, like I met Satya Nadella through this process, right? He ran Microsoft Business Solutions. My time spent with Satya Nadella was wonderful. He showed real creativity. He was real human about wanting to understand the business. Ultimately, we had no takers. And in fact, we got an offer from my current employer, but they walked away after they realized they couldn't fit Intact into their business model. So we were very close to just shutting down the business when we had one investor, and to this day, I'll be forever thankful to him, a gentleman named Brian Jacobs from Emergence Capital. He saw what was happening with Salesforce. He was an early investor there, and he decided that this thing might have some legs, and he led a new series of funding, brought in a new CEO. And from there, the confidence sort of came back, and we started growing for real. But with sort of all of the learnings of a company that almost went out of business, a company where you didn't know, you know, if you were going to get a paycheck, right, on the next payroll run, a company that had to take a call from a customer any day or night because that customer literally was putting food on your table. So we sort of had that mentality, but we had a new set of investors, right? We had an amazing, experienced CEO, and SaaS was starting to be a thing, and we started to grow.
Hey, sport. How was school today?
It was okay, Dad. How was work?
Ugh. Actually, I had a rough day. Leading an engineering team is hard. I mean, I have to ship new software, meet deadlines, and tackle new projects while keeping my team focused on the day-to-day. It's hard to keep up.
Jeepers, Dad. Why don't you call Maris? They're the staffing firm with the best technical resources around. They helped Billy's dad. He used to be stressed out like you. He was missing deadlines, his team was overworked, and a bunch of folks left the company because it was too stressful. But then he called Maris. And they put resources to work right away. He hit all his deadlines and freed up his team to do other work. His boss was so happy that Billy's dad got some extra time off.
Time off? Wow. What did he do with that?
He spent it with Billy. Aww.
That's a swell idea, son. I'll call Maris today. Now, you go wash up for supper.
But again, outside forces can make it tougher. I mean, Q3 of 2008, I think everyone who owned a business then will never forget that period of time. What happened with you guys?
Yeah, I mean, it felt like we had just sort of gained traction. We were reliably growing at about 35% year over year at the time. And the wheels came off for basically any startup at the time. I think it was Sequoia who sent an email to every one of their portfolio companies saying, you know, tighten your belt. There's no funding coming. This is it. One of the things that I'll be forever thankful for is our CEO saw this as an opportunity. You know, he knew that the big software companies would be letting great talent go. He knew that there would be some choice sort of acquisitions to be had if you were clever and knew what you were looking for. And, you know, he decided that was the time to go for it. And like everybody else, you know, our revenue growth took a hit, right? You know, we were sort of relying on the recurring revenue model. But during that time, he encouraged me to go after the sort of engineers that I never in a million years thought that I would be able to convince to come work for me. It's just some brilliant, brilliant people. At the time, we hired two of the three founding engineers for QuickBooks, right? We brought on the team. And that's, you know, this is just like one part of the story. The real talent for engineering, for experience design, and the real talent for doing sort of platforms and APIs really came into the business during the Great Recession when our CEO had the guts to go against the status quo and hire and acquire.
Who was that CEO?
His name was Mike Braun. And again, Mike did not tell me to to plug him. You know, he was the CEO during a great period of time for the company. You know, ultimately, we hired a guy named Rob Reed, who was the CEO for about the last 10 years.
And so you come out the other side of that recession, you start growing kind of at your 35% clip again. What happens in 2017?
I think anybody who's sort of been in a startup that's as old as Intact was when we sold it, everybody is constantly talking to potential acquirers. It is a nonstop activity. It's part of the business, right? You're constantly refining your pitch. You use the same pitch with these acquirers that you use with your venture capitalists. And ultimately, you know, it's a valuation game. Do I raise another round of funding or do I take an offer from one of these targets? And you really get to know the leadership teams across your industry because you're talking to your competitors in a lot of cases. And so we got a call from Sage. We talked to Sage several times over the years. And, you know, I was a bit reluctant to talk to them because we'd had several conversations, including them walking away from the deal when we almost went out of business. And, you know, walking in with sort of a pretty negative expectation, the leadership team just sort of blew me away with their humility, sort of this recognition that the cloud is critical to the life of the business. Sort of like my experience with Satya Nadella, the CTO at the time, a guy named Klaus Michael Vogelberg, he just showed genuine curiosity and enthusiasm for the product and the technology. So, you know, we found a fit with Sage, and that was 2017.
And so you cancel an IPO process, say, all right, let's do the acquisition. You roll in. Do they make a lot of changes or they let you do your own thing for a while?
Well, I think part of that humility that they demonstrated through the process sort of followed after the acquisition. So they did not want to disrupt what we had. You know, we were about $100 million revenue business when they acquired us, growing at 35%. And so, you know, their commitment was to basically leave us alone for a couple of years. And it was sort of a nurturing leave them alone, right? So where we needed resources, we got them. You know, Sage is a very global company. We wanted to expand internationally. So we had resources and markets we wanted to go to that could help us to localize the product. But fundamentally, leaving us alone for a couple of years allowed us to sort of ensure that that momentum continued. You know, fast forward, it's been 6 years now since the acquisition. We're still growing the Intact business at 30% plus, you know, every single year.
A couple of years after the acquisition, though, there are some changes and it ends up with you being appointed global CTO. How does that kind of change your role?
Yeah, you know, I honestly didn't expect that. It was kind of humbling and a huge honor at the same time. I had always respected Sage as a competitor. You know, for 17 years of my life, I competed with Sage. So this was a big deal for me to take on the global CTO role. You know, one of the things that was super helpful was Klaus Michael, who was the prior CTO. He took on a role that was super appropriate for him and what we needed. He became the chief architect for the business, allowing him to really focus on the technology. But, you know, you can imagine going from a 700 employee company, you know, at the time I took on the global role, it was maybe $170, $180 million business. Sage was a $2 billion business, 170, 180 products, 27, 28 countries of operation, products around the world, multiple segments, right? Small business, medium-sized business, accounting, HR, payroll. I mean, for the first 6 months, I was just drinking from a fire hose and learning about the business. But I think, you know, if you sort of grow up as an entrepreneur in a technology business, you always have this curiosity and this sort of eagerness to learn. And so for me, taking on the global CTO role sort of reinvigorated that thirst, you know, to learn. And in some ways, it was almost like doing a startup again, because Sage really needed a bit of a startup vision and a kind of a startup strategy for us to go out and tell the world, here's the business we are building, to tell analysts and investors, here's why you should believe, you know, in our story. In some ways, quite different from being a startup guy, but in some ways, and I think this is partly why the CEO, the new CEO at the time, Steve Hare, part of the reason why he wanted me to do the job is he wanted that startup approach and, you know, the spirit of an entrepreneur to be the global CTO.
A lot of folks, when they get in this position, maybe their engineering team's like, hey, let's re-platform, let's rebuild everything in hot new technology X. Where do you kind of fall on that? How do you evolve things when you have over 170 products with all these different technologies that you've rolled in?
So some advice, and take it or leave it, right? Any engineering VP, CTO out there, re-platforming kills companies. Silicon Valley is littered with companies that failed to keep up with the competition because they were so focused on replatforming. And if you've managed to build a scalable business, despite having some tech debt, you know, allocate more investment than you had to the tech debt. But for heaven's sakes, don't take your eye off the ball on growing the business. So what we really espoused at the time was this philosophy of agility over scaled efficiency. In other words, don't try to have, you know, one platform for every product requiring lots of re-engineering. Instead, create a core set of microservices, you know, APIs that provided some of the common experiences that you want across the portfolio of products. And so whether it was a client server product that was serving construction companies, or a desktop product serving small business, or our native cloud products serving accounting firms, or native cloud products serving medium-sized businesses, every one of those businesses needs integration to banks. They all need integration to payment processors. They're all going to benefit from AI services that help to automate reading data off of an invoice. And so our strategy, super simple, was to create this core platform of services and, you know, allow each of the products to continue evolving on their tech stack, but to allow them to, over time, bring in more and more of the value they deliver to their customers through the central set of services.
Now, you touched on AI there for a second. How would you say AI is changing the industry and Sage in particular?
It's really interesting. We've had AI in products for about 5 years now, but AI has always been sort of very narrowly focused. It's been task focused. And my belief is that if you build the right experience around AI, it's not super obvious to the user that AI is part of the solution. And so we've been using AI pretty prolifically across lots of pieces of our solutions. What changed almost overnight was ChatGPT. You know, everybody's had their moment with ChatGPT, but fundamentally now, large language model, their capability to drive new ways of interacting, their capabilities of sort of chaining together multiple steps in a workflow at their discretion suddenly changes the story for customers. If you really want to create great value using AI, you're not hiding it anymore, right? You're making AI available to interact with. So it's game changing in lots of ways. But the thing that always happens with these waves of technology change is particularly in our industry, you know, we serve the accounting industry, they come with a lot of anxiety, right? It comes with this fear that jobs are going to get disrupted, that, you know, people won't be able to keep up with the skills required for the technology. But our view at Sage is more positive, and I'm pretty confident. The industry has always had a shortage of skilled workers. The industry has always had to focus on these sort of non-negotiable compliance-related chores that are repetitive and a bit low value versus other work they could be doing. And they've never had the time to spend on the more strategic advisory work, you know, other types of work that can really fundamentally, you know, drive the success of a business. And there's this other element, which is ChatGPT and other digital assistants are actually really good at helping people to learn new skills. So through all of this, our story is straightforward. AI is at a point now where we're going to tackle the shortage of skilled workers by making the work more efficient. We're going to attract more people to the industry by making the work more enjoyable. We're going to help to upskill people through the technology itself. And, you know, ultimately the industry will be able to take all the sort of the savings, the time savings to do more valuable work. And it's our job to create technology that supports them in that more valuable work.
I'll make a call back to episode 100 of Underserved to support your point. Eli Goldberg was part of an organization where at their current team size, they looked at their backlog of features and it was 20 years worth of work. So they could certainly use some AI kind of bolt-on robotics to make it faster, make it more enjoyable, and make everyone more productive for sure. Playing with ChatGPT and chatbots, did that help get you interested in coding again?
Yeah, I'm pretty proud of my coding. I don't know where I rank now on the lines of code contributed and still in production for Intact in particular. I stopped coding in 2019 when I took the global CTO job. And wow, I mean, in the 4 years since I took this job, I don't know that I could set up a development environment anymore. I mean, it has changed so dramatically. You know, I suppose that, I mean, I'm sure this has happened to you. It definitely happened to me. I was having sleepless nights after my first interaction with ChatGPT, wondering if, you know, am I really the CTO this company needs? Am I going to be able to keep up? And, you know, what I decided to do was embrace it. And I decided that I could not credibly define the technology strategy for the company if I wasn't hands-on again in this new technology. And so I quietly hired ChatGPT to teach me Python, to teach me, you know, how to set up machine learning environments, what are the tools of the trade. And you get this like remarkably intelligent assistant that you can ask anything to and makes no judgment about your intelligence or lack thereof, right, in the conversation. And I thoroughly loved it, right? I'm not professing now to be an expert at machine learning engineering or Python coding, but my immersion back into it has had a really profound impact on my view of the technology and what we really can do with it in our products to build new and exciting stuff. I've been loving my relationship. And it's not just ChatGPT anymore, right? You know, I use lots of tools now, depending on what I'm trying to do.
So as you guys have continued to grow and acquire companies around the world, you must have a pretty distributed development team all over the place. What are some of the challenges with being that distributed? And what are some of the kind of assets or advantages that you get from having these distributed teams?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. With Sage, our greatest assets are also sort of our biggest challenges. And the thing about Sage that makes it unique is our global nature. So we've got 3,500, probably a little more developers around the world. These developers, you know, came into the business, many of them through acquisitions. We've done a ton of acquisitions over the years. We had a very deliberate strategy of taking our blueprint for business, getting into a new market and acquiring the products that we needed to be successful in that market. That is not the right strategy in the modern, you know, software as a service dominated world. Our strategy now needs to be take your cloud products and, you know, make them work in as many markets as possible. But to do that, you've got to have local expertise, right? You've got to have the ability to really understand the local markets, build the local capabilities. And so a big challenge for me, especially as I was new to the job, was really navigating all of the cultures. And it wasn't just, you know, the difference in culture between a French team and a South African team and a British team and a Silicon Valley team. It's also the culture of a team that came from a client server world and a team that's used to building great desktop software and teams that are doing more cloud stuff. And for some reason, we went through the space acquiring companies that all did Ruby on Rails, right? So, right, bringing Ruby on Rails into the business. And so the diversity of backgrounds and culture and experience there can be really, really difficult to navigate, especially as what you're trying to do is bring it all together. you know, not on a common platform, because now sort of understanding what I just said, that would have completely killed the business. But getting commitment, right, to this global strategy, this global set of services, but actually building out, you know, those local capabilities wouldn't have been possible at the speed we did it without having this global team.
And so, you know, you rewind to, you know, 20-ish years ago, and you're trying to put ads on the internet to get people to give you a credit card and a QuickBooks file. Is there less resistance now about people entrusting you with their data in the cloud, or has it changed?
So we went through a period of time where the resistance was basically gone. And it was such a great feeling for me. I think, you know, a lot of the audience will sort of resonate with this idea that the CTO is also the chief solution consultant, right? You know, the chief sales engineer, and to not have to get on calls with prospects and explain to them why their data is safe was awesome. What's happened now over time, as software as a service has become more mainstream and more industries have embraced it, but also, you know, with this maturity has become a sophisticated understanding, it's back in some ways. It's not us telling a prospect why their data is safe. It's actually more sophistication, like what are your approaches to intruder defense? What sort of, you know, static code analysis have you implemented? Please tell me about your web application firewall and your incident response. We're not having to do this for every prospect, but so one of our big verticals now is financial services. And we tend, when we enter these big verticals, to start to really win at the micro vertical level. And we've just started winning all of the big family offices in the US, right? So imagine, you know, all the top billionaires in the US, their family offices are starting to move over to Sage Intacct. So that conversation that I had in 2002, 2003 with a prospect where I was explaining to them, you know, why we actually do back up your data, don't worry. Right. Imagine now being on a call with the head of IT for Ray Dalio's family office. The intensity of the conversation is quite different. And so, you know, there's always work for us to do to build more tools to overcome these sorts of challenges in the sales cycle, but it is back. The thing that I think is remains to be true is customers see the value in not having to do this stuff themselves.
What would you say your vision is for the future of accounting, given all of these changes and innovations?
We've had a North Star for innovation for quite a long time. I think I first talked about it 7 years ago, which essentially is, you know, the accounting industry is locked into cycles. And it has been for centuries. You know, every accounting team is sort of evaluated on how long it takes them to complete the monthly close. So they have to go through monthly closes. There's quarterly tax filings. You know, there's your regular inventory cycle counts, annual audits. Everything about the accounting world is cycles. And the problem with cycles is they only give you point in time visibility. And, you know, the reason why an accounting team is evaluated on how long it takes them to close the books is because that's the measure of how old the data is by the time you get that. That visibility. And so our vision is really straightforward. It's to transform the industry into an industry that provides continuous strategic value, where we've eliminated the monthly close. I have to say this carefully, but I mean it, right? Where we've eliminated today's type of annual audit, where decision makers always have real-time visibility into the business activity. We've paired automation with investments in assurance and trust, so that not only do they have the real-time business activity, but they've got confidence that it's accurate and the business is operating within, you know, the controls and the expectations of their stakeholders. And that because we've invested this time in automating this non-negotiable, repetitive, sort of compliant related work for the accounting team, we're now investing in technology that enables them to provide the strategic insights in a, you know, current, not only looking backwards at results, but actually using AI now to forecast future performance. That's it. Straightforward. You know, we're going to kill all the cycles in the accounting industry. We're going to turn it into a continuous processing industry where the industry provides real-time strategic guidance to the stakeholders.
Now, as I think about your career and kind of get out the measuring tape, you know, yeah, there's some M&A in there, but let's call it the same company. You've been basically like leading engineering CTO for 23-ish years. That's got to be close to a Valley record.
Yeah, I can think of a couple of other CTOs who have stuck it out as long as I have, but not a lot. CTO's insatiable curiosity often leads them to try something new. And so, you know, they move on to the next thing that's fulfilling that insatiable curiosity. So it is, it's a bit odd for a CTO to stick it out as long as I did. And I was having this conversation with somebody recently. You know, we were talking about lessons learned and, you know, what were the big things that you did to enable the company to be successful? And the answer is, as unsexy as it sounds, is just showing up every day, right? You know, just picking up the phone when a customer calls. Young people won't know this story, but if you're of a certain age, you remember the Dunkin' Donuts commercials that were totally focused on this sort of beat down, super tired, dark circles under the eyes. I think he gets out of bed. It's a chef, gets out of bed in the morning already wearing a dirty apron.
Time to make the donuts.
Exactly. Not super sexy, but at least 50% of our success at Intact came from just always showing up. Always picking up the phone, always being there for the customer, always making sure that the problems got resolved. Never, ever, ever walking away, even when things don't look super great, you know, like they did in the early 2000s and during the Great Recession.
Show up, get things done, be nice to people, don't quit.
Yeah, pretty straightforward. No one's going to write a book about that anybody's going to want to read, but, you know, I think that's actually the recipe.
So in order to avoid being burnt out and in order to spend some time doing different things, what do you do when you're away from keyboard? I think you'd like to spend some time in the saddle.
Yeah, I do quite a bit of cycling. I've got a home in Vermont that I sort of escape to, and I like to do gravel bikes there. I do kayaking. I hike. I ski. And I'm going to admit this publicly for the first time. During COVID, my kids and I got into PC gaming. So, you know, we built gaming PCs together. And COVID is over, but the therapy that I've learned to embrace that comes from gaming persists. And I will still often end a long day with a game that allows me to sort of escape and reset.
There's no shaming in gaming.
Oh, I like that.
So, Aaron, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Thanks so much for having me. I had a ball.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.